stories of people whose faith has been tested, renewed, and sometimes discovered in the face of real-life situations. Faith in the real world. Step into the high-octane world of racing and discover the remarkable journey of a true champion, Al Unser Jr. This fearless racer soared to victory at the Indianapolis 500 not once, but twice. But behind the checkered flags, his life was far from a smooth ride. Addiction, setbacks, and doubts. Al faced them head on, proving that the true measure of a champion lies not just in wins, but in rising above the challenges when the race of life hits the wall. Today, we celebrate Al Unser Jr.'s incredible journey of victory, defeat, resilience, and faith. A true champion, both on and off the track. Please welcome Al Unser Jr.
Thank you.
Have a seat, sir. Well, I want to add my personal word of thanks to you, to your wife Norma, for joining us today, making time to be here, Al. It's a great honor. It is a tremendous honor. Let's start with racing. Would you have ever gotten into racing were it not for your dad and your uncle?
Well, the answer is no. I mean, you know, I was born into it, but I just want to say what a great honor it is to be here with all of you today. I'm just so grateful that we're able to be here. This is something that I never thought in my wildest dreams I would be sitting here with you guys today, and so I am just truly honored and just very thankful to Jesus to be able to share my story.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. So thinking about your getting into racing, it's obviously the family business. Mm-hmm. Your dad, Al Sr., won 4 Indy 500s. Your uncle Bobby won 3. And when you won your second in 1994, I calculated that the Unsers represented 12% of all of the BorgWarner trophies that had ever been won in the history of the race. I mean, the Unsers and the Indy 500 go together like milk and checkered flags.
Well, we've been very blessed. Let's put it that way, you know.
When you were a kid, and by the way, I've got your book, and we've got some copies available outside for folks who might want to pick one up. Great book.
Thank you.
Do an incredible job of telling your story, telling about racing, and making it very accessible, even with a lot of the complexities about racing. You explained it in a way that you really get and you understand. You tell a story in here about when you were little, you were with your sister, I believe, and you were with your dad out somewhere, and I don't know how many 500s he had won at that point, but somebody came up and asked him for an autograph, and you guys got the biggest kick out of that. Like, why do people want my dad's autograph?
We did. Yep, it was my sisters and I, and actually, it was, I remember it clearly, it was up at Milwaukee. It was after the Indy 500, and I think it was 1972. I think Gordon Johncock had won the race. But we were checking into the hotel, and a little girl and a little boy came walking up and asked Dad for his autograph, and me and my sister just went, why would anybody want Dad's autograph, you know? We kind of laughed.
He's just Dad.
He's just Dad, and we kind of laughed at them for asking for Dad's. And as soon as they walked away, my dad really just grabbed all three of us, my two sisters and I, and he said, "Don't do that again." You know, that's an honor for them to come up and ask me for my autograph, and so don't make fun of anybody. To do that. So
when did the racing bug bite? How old were you when you kind of started thinking, I love this. This is cool.
I remember the exact moment. It was, I was 8 years old, and the Indy 500, I was in Albuquerque, the Indy 500, my sisters and I, and the race was on closed circuit TV back in those days. And so we went down to the Civic Auditorium to watch the Indy 500. And it was my dad's first win, 1970, in the Johnny Lightning car. Mm-hmm. And right then, the car and dad and everything were just bigger than life. It was just bigger than life to me. And ironically, right at that time, there was a go-kart track built just about a mile away from our house where we lived. And so I just kept bugging Dad, I want to race go-karts. Let me drive the go-karts. And so he eventually did. So.
And then it took off from there.
Yeah.
You started with the go-kart racing. You worked your way up into different levels. By the time you got a driver's license and you were legal to drive on the road,
yeah.
How fast had you gone in a vehicle?
Not that fast, to be honest. Before I had I had my license before I was allowed to drive sprint cars, and that's what I started. So I started in go-karts, and then when I was 16 years old, I went to the sprint cars. And you had to have a driver's license in order to do that. So yeah, I hadn't been that fast. I probably had been faster on a snowmobile during the winter time than I had in an automobile. So I
came from NASCAR country, and I remember NASCAR drivers telling me about the different, you know, like kart racing and other things they did before, and how fast they would go when they were, you know, 14 years old. Now, in the South, they probably get around a few things. Maybe it's a little bit different down there, but they said they were going really fast by the time they were ever on the road. But you have gotten into racing, and you talk about how the Indy 500 was the deal for you. Like, early on, that was the deal. You lived in New Mexico. You weren't even surrounded by that idea here. Was it an obsession for you?
It was a dream. It was a childhood dream, and it all started on that Memorial Day in 1970 when I was 8 years old, and you know, I just wanted, that's all I just, every waking moment, every sleeping moment was all about, you know, the Indy 500, and I just dreamed about it, and it's just something that just, I had to do. It was like a calling.
Yeah.
You know, simply put, and I didn't think about anything else other than that.
Yeah. So, in 1989, you're running in the Indy 500, and I know there's sort of a faith thought about this experience that we'll come back to later.
Okay.
But that was how many 500s had you run by this point, by 1989?
Well, my first year was 1983.
Oh, okay.
So it had been several, you know.
You've been in several, but
several,
now you are in a hot race to win the thing. And you and Fittipaldi are neck and neck in the last lap of the race. And something happens. We actually have a clip of that. Can we run that clip?
Okay.
Let's take a look at it.
Okay.
Fine. And now Ammo has a lap and a half.
Here we go. Here he goes.
Ammo
pass.
On the inside. Here comes. Oh, he blocks him down low.
Ammo didn't like that.
And they're still side by side going into turn three. Ammo down low in the middle of the track, and Ammo may have it. They almost touch
wheels. Oh, they did touch
wheels. And into the wall is Al Jr. Ammo continues on. They touch wheels in turn three. Ammo continues on. You can see the damage to the Valvoline number two, Al Unser Jr.
Al tried to make that move to the inside because he knows his car was pushing in traffic, and it was just a race. I don't know what Al thinks, but I think Al moved down into him and made a bad judgment, but I'm sure he thinks differently.
Well, let's
but
see
I know
what
his car was
is.
Pushing.
when Emo comes by, let's watch the reaction from Al Unser Jr. What a battle down the backstretch. The checkered flag is going to come out. That was on lap 199. They bang wheels, and that is an altercation that could have made Raul Boisel the champion here, because both of those drivers could have been eliminated. Now, there is Al.
So what do you say?
What kind of a shot was that? I don't know.
I think he's saying, hell of a race, guy. You know, way to go.
It looked that way anyway.
That's what I think. That's what I think.
There did not appear to be any animosity whatsoever with that gesture.
No. Nope.
And Emerson Fittipaldi, under the yellow, is going to win the 1989 running of the Indianapolis 500.
So take us back to that moment. take us back. You've been touched, crashed into the wall. I mean, you were looking at a chance to win, and what were you going to do?
Well, as I was taking my helmet off and so on, you know, once I got the helmet off and then I started out towards the track, one of the safety crewmen there, he stood in front of me and he goes, where are you going? And I said, well, I'm going out there. And he goes, what, do you want to flip him off? And I went, yes. You know, and he was so funny because he steps aside and he goes, go right ahead. Okay, so I went out on the track, and what I look at it now and it's just seconds before Emerson shows up, but to me at that time, I had a moment of clarity. I had so many things going through my head and knowing where I was and that, you know, all the people watching on TV and I had a thought of my dad back when I was go-karting we watched a kid get crashed out and he got out of his go-kart and he took his helmet off and he threw it into the go-kart and seat, and my dad looked at me and he goes, if I ever see you do that, you're done racing. All these thoughts came into my head at that, and it was Emerson. He was coming around for his first Indy 500 win. He's a godfather to my second daughter, Shannon, at that time. You know, wow. I mean, Emerson, the last thing Emerson would ever do would be to hurt another driver. You know, I mean, he actually pulled Niki Lauda out of his F1 car when it was on fire and saved his life. And so it was Emerson. And so all I could do was just congratulate him on his first Indy 500 win. And so that's why I gave him.
So you had this moment of clarity. All these thoughts go through your head. And what did you do? You like clapped your hands for him and gave him thumbs up.
Yep. I clapped my hands and gave him thumbs up. And, you know, congratulations. Now, later on in life, you know, I shared that with my small group last few years, a couple of years ago, and one of my friends in the small group, who's with us today, Lane.
Oh, nice.
He's with us today, and Lane goes, you know, Al, that was the Holy Spirit. Mm. And I went, really? You think so? And he goes, absolutely. Mm. That was the Holy Spirit coming into you and experiencing the Holy Spirit in a whole new way after I got baptized and so on. It absolutely 1,000% was the Holy Spirit.
I've been thinking a lot how I'm going to come back to that point about the spiritual reflection on it in a moment, but I've been thinking a lot about that moment of clarity. And I'm looking at our news and what goes on right now in our own city, much less the rest of the country, every day, where people are just reacting to their anger and what they think got taken from them, and they don't have the moment of clarity. They don't perhaps have the parent's voice from childhood going, don't you ever do that again.
Right.
Something,
right.
And then even being able to think about the other person and go, okay, now wait a minute, put this in perspective. And anyway, I've just been aware of that more and more as I look at what's going on and the need for helping people have thoughts that give them a pause. So about that experience, obviously you guys clapped. You're familiar with it. You know that what was a loss ends up kind of becoming a positive for your career. What did that do for your career?
It absolutely did. It, you know, the FIA, the Formula One World Sanctioning Body, the FIA, they actually created an award that year of Sportsmanship of the Year award. And so my first wife and I, Shelley, and I went to Europe to accept this award. And it's just, it's something that people have actually, you know, years later, I've had fans come up to me, fathers that have their sons, who the father was the son at that time. They've grown up and they've come up and they've said, Al, what you did that day, I was a kid and my dad said, that's pure sportsmanship and learn from it. And now I'm teaching that to my son and I'm letting him know that. And so,
so now,
it's come back in way many different ways.
So now you're getting immortalized. You've got kids putting Al Unser Jr. posters in their room. And you are just the model character. But behind the scenes, what was going on?
Behind the scenes, it was really tough. It was really tough. I had a disease, a substance use disorder disease. I really feel my wife Shelley at the time, we were both in the throes of that, and as that started over time, it just started taking over and so on, and it started creating what I call in the book two different Al's. There's the Al Jr., which is the one out on the racetrack and so on, and then there's Al Jr., the husband and father at home, and they're going in different directions because of the substances of overtaking my my confidence, my self confidence, my self worth was going down personally, and then at the same time, my racetrack, the Al Jr. racetrack, winning races, being successful, that was just going up. So they were just really separating these two different personalities.
Almost like your body is being stretched. Something's going to snap.
And it did. Yeah.
So you've got this going on behind the scenes, a substance abuse problem that is increasing. Probably at that time, alcohol mainly for you?
No, actually, it was more drug related. It was more marijuana.
Okay.
Drinking for me didn't start until later in my career. So.
And then your wife at the time, with whom you were deeply in love, has a substance abuse problem. So there's not anything going on in your life to put it in check, to be a counterbalance to that.
Correct. There was nothing there. There was, you know, my family, we didn't go to church when I was growing up and so on. And so we believed in God, like my father and my Uncle Bobby. I truly believe they believed in God, but we didn't have a relationship with God. There was no going to church. There was no studying the Word when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, as I've gotten older now, I truly wished that had happened and so on, you know, because as we got older, Shelley and I, and everything started unraveling. Then divorce came into the picture, and then that just hurts my four kids, you know, which I'm still rebuilding relationships with them, you know.
So who was God to you when you were racing at that time?
God to me, when I talk to God, And then the only really time I talked to God was when I was in the race car and I was going, please God, let me win this race today.
Yeah.
And then when the race was over, whether I won or lost, when the race was over, when I got out of the car, God stayed in the car. And I went on with my life, and it was, you know, I was really very selfish and so on. So
God was a desperation for helping you be successful. But once you were out of the race car, you didn't think about it. I got to do
Absolutely.
A ride-along a few years ago. So I went 185 miles an hour in a ride-along.
In the two-seater.
I talked to God a lot.
I bet you did.
In that couple of minutes. I talked to God a heck of a lot. I was thinking about that comment, and it reminded me of ancient cultic religions, where people would pray to the gods, make the sun shine so my plants grow, make the rain come, help my cattle to do well. And I thought, really, it's kind of like a cultic religion. You get in the car and it's about, oh, you know, God,
help me
succeed.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So you talk about you started out smoking marijuana. Can you remember what would have been a reason in your life for turning to any kind of drug use? When did that, what might have caused that to start?
Rob, it happened so early in my life. You know, I was in high school and, excuse me, it was something that my peers were doing, my friends were doing. And so it was just something to do. And you know, what started out as just, you know, every now and then partying kind of thing, and it grew into something else, and how it grew into something else, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've thought about it where, you know, everything was really positive in my life in my late teens and early 20s. You know, I was racing, my childhood dreams were coming true, mm-hmm. in a positive way. When I was 21 years old, you know, I was racing the Indy 500 when I was 21, and honestly, I had figured that out because my birthday is in April. I had figured that out when I was 10 and 11 years old, what year I was gonna be old enough to even compete in the Indy 500, and that was 1983. And
wow.
All of these came true, and so it was all positive stuff that was going on in my life, and so how it got out of control, I just...
But you did have some family trauma happen to you, didn't you?
We did.
Perhaps even as a boy?
We did. Yes, the first real pain that happened in my life was when my father and my mom got divorced. And I was 9 years old, and so, you know, that was the first real setback, you know, that, and I think that kind of hurt me too, in the aspect that mom and dad had split up, and now, you know, after school, my sisters and I were kind of free to do whatever we wanted to do,
right.
kind of thing, and so, you know. Idle hands is the devil's workshop kind of thing, and so that could have been what was going on. So
then you had a death in the family,
and then yep later on when I was 20 years old, actually before I had gotten to Indianapolis, my sister Debbie, who's the middle sister, she was in a dune buggy accident in southern New Mexico at a lake. And she was killed instantly, and so it was just out of the blue, you know. Debbie actually raced go-karts, and she was pretty good, you know. She was pretty good, and so it was a shame about all that.
We talked about this before very briefly, but, you know, we've wondered if there had been a church influence when your parents divorced when you were a boy, maybe some neighbors who would have come over and talked to your parents and say, hey, we want to pick up Al Jr. and take him to Vacation Bible School or something like that. You feel like that could have made a huge difference?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've actually talked with my mom about this, and my mom, I asked her, actually, we had lunch yesterday, and I asked her permission if I could tell her story in a little bit. And she said, sure, I would love that. And so my mom, when my sister died in Albuquerque, it was 1982, and my mom was basically alone. She didn't go to church at that time and so on. And in 1989, she moved back to Indianapolis, okay, married a mechanic that Mike Devon, my stepdad, wonderful man. And it was later on in the early 90s that she come to be reborn. She came to find a life with Jesus and to follow Jesus, okay? And I know for a fact she had been praying ever since that time. She had been praying that I find Jesus. Mm. You know, we talked about that yesterday. And then unfortunately, in 2009, my older sister passed away with an aneurysm. So both of my sisters passed unexpectedly, all of a sudden, right? And my mom, after Mary Linda's death in 2009, she told me that her grieving was easier, if that's a word. You know, it was tough. She had lost her daughter, okay, and both daughters now. And my mom said, you know, with Jesus's help, she knows she's going to see him again, okay. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that she mentioned yesterday, which you mentioned, that when Debbie passed away in Albuquerque, she had no one. Yeah. She had just no one that support her or anything like that. Mm-hmm. When my sister passed away in 2009, she had her church community, and she mentioned it yesterday, the support that she got from her church and her friends and her community was just totally, totally different, and which helped her through the grieving process. So.
I appreciate that word. I think it's a great encouragement to all of us to never underestimate the power of our own influence with neighbors, with other people, to have a friendship of trust when they go through a tragedy. And maybe there are little kids involved, and to go and say, would you mind if we take the children to Sunday school one Sunday? Or you never know what that can do. For you now, as a young adult, well, let's just say you're 20s, 30s. Mm-hmm. You're successful. You've got a shadow side going on. Would anybody have been inviting you to church during that time? Would anybody say, hey, Al, come to church with us?
The fact is they did not.
Okay.
And because I lived in Albuquerque and so on, and they did not. But I've kind of thought about, had they asked me, I'd have said, no, I'm okay. I'd have said, no.
You're doing fine.
My life is going great, so on and so forth.
Has it crashed? So,
yep. No, it's all good.
So let's get to the crash.
Yeah.
That's an ugly crash we saw a while ago. You walked away from it.
Yep.
But I would say emotionally, the crash you describe in the opening introduction of this book. I told Al earlier, I read the book, then getting ready this weekend, I went back and read the introduction again because it kind of went into racing so quick. I forgot the power. I said, you describe hopelessness about as well as anybody I've ever heard describe it. Your 50th birthday.
Yep.
Take us to that moment.
It was the darkest time in my life. I had I was in a divorce, excuse me, with my second wife at the time, and I had gotten another DUI in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Albuquerque Police Department was trying to put me in jail, and they had, you know, all the right stuff to get that done and so on. And so now, you know, like I said, my birthday is in April. It's my 50th birthday. April comes, The only one that called me to wish me a happy birthday was my mom and my oldest son. Was the only one that no one else did. I was utterly alone at that time, and just didn't want to live. I didn't want to live anymore, and so. The gun was coming out every evening, and I just couldn't figure out how I had gotten here. Mm-hmm. You know, where before, you know, my life was the Indy 500 winner and all that kind of stuff, and just, you know, one of the most popular drivers in America and in the 80s in the world, you know, about going Formula One and all that kind of stuff. And how did I get here on my 50th birthday? I just couldn't figure it out. And so that's when I really started trying to do my homework on why all this happened and so on. And so
how did you come to faith?
I came to faith actually here in Indianapolis. And so I got through that dark time in 2012. I ended up moving back here in the fall of 2017. I still did not have a relationship with God. God was something that was just...
Still back in the race car.
Yeah, but just no relationship, you know, and so on. And I had tried these different programs to stop the abuse of the substances and so on, and nothing seemed to be working at all. And during these years of before I moved here, I would come back here in the month of May, like 2013, 2014, mm-hmm. 2015, and I would stay with my mom. She has a guest house, mm-hmm. and I would stay with her, I would take her to church on Saturday evenings at Connection Point in Brownsburg. That was where she went, and I'm just being the good son. I'm just being the good son, take mom to church and so on. And when I moved back here in 2017, that was just a normal occurrence going on. Mm-hmm. So it happened all the time that I would take my mom to church. And so there one day, I believe it was in 2019, there one day, you know, I'm in church with mom and so on, and listening into Pastor John talk, and it dawned on me that, you know, I had never really given Jesus, believing in Jesus, being a follower of Jesus, I had never really given that a try. And so I was looking around the church and I'm going, you know, and Pastor John was actually pointing this out, that our calendar is off of his birth, you know, right. or death, okay, around Jesus. It's our calendar. And millions around the world are followers of Jesus. And I kind of went, you know, I should give this a try to become a follower and a believer. And right then I went, I'm going to give this a try. And that instant in church, my stomach got warm. I got a real relaxing feeling over my entire body. And from that point forward, I have been a follower of Jesus Christ.
You know, some people who don't have quite that experience, and I love that description because John Wesley, the founder of the Methodist Church, talks about his moment of surrender and conversion being like having his heart strangely warmed. Yep. And it's very, very similar.
Yep.
And some people say, well, gosh, I didn't have that experience. I think God gives us the experiences we need based on our road that brought us to that point. But what I liked about hearing you describe it is that faith is real. A relationship with Jesus Christ is meant to bring peace and hope and help to our lives. And it sounds like that's what you found in that moment. Like there's power in this. What was your journey like after that? What did it mean to pursue that relationship?
Well, it's been fantastic, you know, and it's growing. It's an ongoing process, okay? And really right away, what happened was the fact that all of a sudden, instead of just believing in God, I had formed and began a relationship with God where Jesus was, I want to say, the bridge that gapped this relationship by believing in Jesus and the fact that that he died for my sins. That was one of the things that really I had a hard time with, was being able to forgive myself for all of the sins that I had done through my life and so on, these two different people and all that and so on. And so it was really hard to forgive myself. And once I started that relationship with Jesus and then started having a real relationship with God, that he's not this bad guy, that he's a good guy and that he loves me very much and so on. And it just started flourishing from there. And so today I'm happily married to my beautiful wife, Norma. And we study the Word all the time. I was truly blessed with her when one of our first dates, all we did was listen to Christian music in the car. And so
you went, this is different.
It was great. It was way different, and it has been way different. I can honestly say that with the substances and so on, that stole my self-worth and self-confidence, and it's because of Jesus and God's love, I have the courage to sit here today with you folks and write the book and tell the truth about the book and put myself out there. The whole purpose for the book was to help someone.
Yeah,
that is in that disease.
We're coming to a close. I wanted to give you one last question to respond to. If you were talking to an Al Jr. of 40 years ago, or to anyone today who might be listening, who maybe has been living on a fast track, but secretly and inwardly they know that things are not as they should be, as they would want them to be, but this whole talk of Jesus, this whole talk of faith, just seems like, no, I don't need that. What would you say? What would you say to him?
Well, my mom and I talked about that yesterday, because as believers, we try so hard to share that excitement and that love and so on. And it's hard for them to get it, okay? But for me, it was something that it freed me. I was in chains of depression and addiction and all of that. And by believing in Jesus and following Jesus, it was a freedom that it just broke the chains and broke the ropes and of all kinds of things. Depression, mental illness, all this stuff comes from having the enemy work on you so on. And so Jesus has allowed me to do
liberating.
That. It absolutely. Yeah. And that's hard to get across, but I know my mom prayed since she became a follower for me to become a follower. And when the day that happened, she was thrilled. She was super
What I
happy.
Love about this book is there is nothing self-righteous in it. There is zero self-righteousness. In fact, reading this story, there were parts along the way where I'm like, oh my gosh, dude, stop, stop. And you are so honest. And so it's kind of like you are willing to meet people in the shadows. And it seems
Absolutely.
Like that's kind of what you communicate here. Look, I've got my shadows and I'm gonna be open. I'm gonna put some light on it and hope that connects with people. So if you're sitting there going, boy, I'd like to hear more, I'd like this conversation to continue, I encourage you to pick up a copy, because it is a helpful book, and it might be something you find helpful to put in someone else's hands. So we need to close, and I'd like to do that by just lifting up a prayer, if I may.
Thank you.
Gracious God, I thank you for Al Unser Jr. It's been an amazing life. There have perhaps been many moments when lots of people would have looked at his life and said, I wish I was Al Unser Jr. But the glory is not the accolades, the trophies, the success. The glory is where you meet us and find us. And that worldly glory always fades. And I thank you for his story of coming to trust in you and the power of finding liberation and hope. Bless his marriage with Norma. Continue to keep them strong in your care. And for his mom and for their family and the way they can continue to be a source of light and hope to others, may you continue to use them and shine light through their lives. I pray in Christ's holy name.